Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. Here's something that might surprise you. When you look at illegal activities around the world, the leading two are no doubt the trade in drugs and in arms. But perhaps the third biggest illegal international activity is, in fact, the trade in smuggled art. We'll be talking this morning a bit about that and about what governments and international organizations are trying to do to stop that. It is a significant problem because for the countries that are losing things, particularly antiquities, it means they're losing their cultural heritage. And it's also something of a loss for the world when objects are removed from the places where they originated. Then if they get away from there, we really don't know very much about them, where they came from, perhaps who made them, how old they are. So it's also a loss of knowledge about the world's artistic heritage. And our guest this morning is someone who's spent a lot of time thinking about this and writing on these issues. Our guest is Patty Gerstenblith. She is professor of law at DePaul University. She's an internationally known specialist in law and cultural heritage and has taught and published widely in the areas of law and the arts. She came to this actually through art history. She went to Harvard, where she got a degree in art history and did work as an archaeologist for a while before she started to become interested in the legal aspects of the subject. So then she went back to law school. She went to Northwestern and got her law degree there and has been working in this area now for some time. She's visiting the campus, gave a talk last night, has been meeting with students and faculty, and was good enough to include a stop here on the program, so we're pleased to have her here. And as we talk, questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. All you have to do, if you'd like to be a part of the program, is to pick up the phone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call, so you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And any and all questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can get in as many people as would like to be included. Well, good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me here.
I'm sure that if you had asked me the question, okay, what are the biggest illegal activities around the world, I probably would have guessed drugs. Maybe I could have gotten the arms trade. But I think probably I never would have guessed that stolen art would be such a big thing. How much money are we talking about?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to estimate the amount of money because much of the trade is illegal and underground. And also the agencies, the police agencies like Interpol, are very tight-lipped about this information. But the estimates have ranged from between $2 billion to $6 billion a year. That includes not just antiquities, but other kinds of artworks that are stolen, as well as the illegally exported, the smuggled antiquities that you mentioned before.
Yeah. And I guess we should make sure people understand we are talking about a broad range of things. Probably when you say a phrase like stolen art, people think of thieves breaking into a museum, for example, and taking something off the wall, or breaking into someone's house and taking something from their private collection. We're also talking about people taking antiquities, going to sites, temples, other sorts of things, and taking whole pieces of buildings, statuary, taking things out of the ground. They might be things that had been discovered and cataloged already. They might be things that perhaps we're not widely known, so there was no record of it, which probably makes that easier to traffic in. But here we're talking about a very wide range of things, and some of these objects, in fact, very, very large things that you would think this would be difficult to remove, to ship. It's not like something you could put in your pocket or put in a suitcase.
Right. We do have examples of monumental wall reliefs and sculptures that have come from places like Angkor Wat in Cambodia, Chinese tomb reliefs that were on sale in New York by Christie's to be auctioned off, and monumental reliefs that have actually been taken out of Iraq, not only facing the difficulties you mentioned, but also defying the boycott against things exiting from Iraq as well. And some of these reliefs are larger than human size. So it is quite remarkable that they managed to overcome the logistical as well as the legal impediments to transport these things, and yet it is done. And as you said, whether they range from things that have been documented in place and therefore are known to things that were completely unknown before, in either case, there is great destruction of the world's cultural heritage through this kind of illegal activity.
Mm. When you look at the various kinds of thefts, and again, I guess I'm thinking about going back to what people would mostly think of if you talked about art theft. Is there indeed still a lot of theft either from museums or from private collections?
There is certainly theft from museums. We can think of back 10 years ago to the theft of the paintings from the Gardner Museum in Boston, theft of paintings that are unique and easily documented and well-known. They have never surfaced. They would not be saleable in any kind of public setting. Nobody knows where they are, but we assume they're sitting on somebody's wall in somebody's basement or private room, and someone is enjoying them. Perhaps there's been speculation that this is a way of laundering money, perhaps connected with the drug market. There is evidence that the routes that illegal art, that stolen art follows, parallels the routes that particularly the illegal trade in drugs parallels through parts of Europe. So perhaps this is a way of converting illegal money into a hard asset. But since they are not saleable on the market publicly, they would have to be part of clandestine transactions. There has been more recently, for instance, just over Christmas this year, there was a theft from one of the museums in Scandinavia where some people came in at gunpoint and held up the guards and paintings were taken. Now, the people have been apprehended, but the paintings have not been returned yet. So there is ongoing theft from museums, and the issue of museum security. Insurance is prohibitive to a lot of museums because these paintings can be worth millions of dollars, and they are not replaceable. So this is certainly a real issue, theft out of museums. But as you said, it's something that's easier for most people to understand than the other kind of theft, which is the looting from sites of unknown material, which is saleable on the market because, as you said, it's not documented. It's not known to be hot items. So there's a real difference in the way those kinds of theft work.
Yeah. Well, for governments around the world, what are some of the problems that they have in controlling the removal of their important cultural material, having people come and either people who live there thinking, well, this is a way that we can make some money by selling this, or outsiders thinking the same thing, this here's a very marketable commodity. We can come and we can scoop it up and we can take it. What are some of the problems that the governments have in preventing that?
Problems are, of course, poverty. A pot dug up somewhere in South America or Asia might be worth the equivalent of a month's salary or even more than a month's salary to some local person. So poverty is certainly a problem. Education is a problem. People need to understand that this is part of their heritage, and they would, in fact, benefit in the long term economically more through preservation of this information and sites and material than through selling off something. Of course, policing activities, having adequate funding of police to be able to monitor sites. The sites are very numerous. They're spread out. Many of them are unknown. And so to adequately police them is very difficult. We actually have the same problem in the United States, something that we often think of only happening in third world countries. But it happens particularly in the southwestern part of the United States where sites are also looted. And I don't think we have the same excessive level of poverty or even lack of education. But inadequate law enforcement, I think, is a universal problem.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. We'll bring him into the conversation, and probably I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Patty Gerstenblith. She's professor of law at DePaul University, and this is her area of specialty, law and the arts, law and cultural heritage. And we're talking here about the international market in stolen art antiquities. And if you have questions, you can call 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with in Champaign, line one.
Hi. This is a great issue, and I think you raised a couple of points, but one of the ones that I would think is pretty thorny is that there's a large precedent that's been set by many of the developed nations. I'm thinking of the former imperialist powers, such as, say, England, going into, for example, Turkey. I visited Turkey several years ago, and you know, the British Museum has countless numbers of sarcophagi and other relics that they just appropriated and took for themselves. And I don't see any efforts on their part to return them to the rightful owners. I mean, you could go right up to the crown jewels, which they took from some of them from the Taj Mahal in India. I mean, I don't see them planning to return them anytime soon. So I think an argument could be made that I'm not condoning any of it, but the people who are stealing the stuff now, at least they live in the countries and they are poor and they need to eat. So, I mean, in the case of Angkor Wat, I've heard that many of the thefts are really individuals, not so organized, but that they're just, you know, sort of selling them to middlemen then who are organized, and then they end up in Bangkok or in Christie's or wherever. So, but, you know, we, as the, you know, speaking for the West, we've set the precedent for this, so to speak, by going in and sort of plundering these cultures before they had any sort of organization. How do we address that when we tell them to stop selling their own heritage?
You're certainly right that many of the Western museums benefited from colonialism and imperialism that led to looting throughout much of Asia, Africa, South and Central America. One thing is that I think that although we look at the individual who may plunder something today and say, well, we have sympathy for them because, of course, their dire economic circumstances, but perhaps unwittingly they are part of still a market which takes those objects through almost the same path that you're talking about. They still end up with organized rings. Maybe the original person is acting individually, but when the object is sold up the line through various middlemen and dealers to smugglers and ultimately to museums and private collectors, this is still an organized ring and activity that is, in a sense, a kind of cultural imperialism or colonialism that is still going on today. So I think we need to recognize that connection. Public pressure is certainly being brought on some museums, such as the British Museum, to return at least some of the objects. So far, the British Museum has certainly been intransigent about that. But public opinion in Britain, for example, favors return of the marbles to the Acropolis, to the Parthenon in Athens. And whether that will eventually produce return of some of these objects, of course, I'm not sure, but it is a possibility. I should say also that several museums, particularly in the United States, have been the subject of claims for more recently taken material, such as from Turkey and Italy. And some of those objects have been returned, and I think that those have an effect to deter future looting, or at least I would hope that they do.
I think you're right. I mean, I think if we return some of the things and say, you know, we were wrong and we'd like them to go back to the rightful owners, then at least you have a case to be made to these people who are taking today their own heritage. But I'll just raise one last point and I'll hang up and listen. That is that I'm not so sure you can make the argument that by leaving these cultural icons in place, items in place, that they benefit in the long term economically. I mean, you can make that argument, but if I pay $10 to go see Palenque, for example, in Mexico, that goes to the government, and I would wager that it's not trickling down to the Mayans' descendants who live in the area. I mean, it goes to the government. It's filtered through various levels of bureaucracy, largely corrupt in the case of many Latin American countries, and certainly in, say, South Asia. These people never see a dime of that. You have the same problem with the cocoa farmers in Colombia. How do you tell them to grow coffee or something else when they can make, you know, $5 a month growing coffee and $500 a month growing cocoa leaves? I mean, I think it's a difficult argument to make at the ground level, and we have to figure out some way of doing it. Otherwise, I mean, just, you know, unless you have a moratorium, which is hard to enforce, like, say, in the case of ivory, it's just not going to stop.
Right. Certainly bribery and corruption is a problem throughout the world. But UNESCO and other kinds of international organizations are working on trying to create a sustainable cultural heritage within many third world countries. And I think the way that the, as you refer to it, as trickle down can occur is through the opening of local museums, the hiring of guards and people to work in the museums and guides through the sites. So I think it might be easier to see an economic benefit accruing than what we get, for example, in trying to turn to other kinds of crops when we discourage people from growing illegal drugs. So it is hoped that through more education and an understanding of these issues by international funding agencies, as well as technical expertise that can be provided through agencies such as UNESCO, that in fact we can convert into a sustainable local economic benefit to local populations to help them come out of the extreme poverty that does lead them to loot their own heritage.
Certainly, we know there is a long history of looting associated with colonialism, but also with war. That people who, you know, the victors, they round up everything that's not tied down and it's worth anything, and they take it home with them, and have been doing that for, as far as we know, probably forever. Is that still happening? Is there still looting associated with war, and is it going on now?
There is less of it. I don't want to say that it doesn't go on, but there is at least now an international recognition in both international conventions and what's called customary international law that artworks and cultural objects should no longer be war booty. I think that the bigger threat today is when one country or one group within a nation destroys part of a cultural heritage that belongs to a different group as a way of trying to obliterate the memory of that group. And of course, we see that going on today in Afghanistan with the Taliban that is trying to destroy the statuary that belongs to a different culture. We certainly saw that in the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, where churches and mosques were being destroyed by the other side, or the library at Sarajevo was bombed. But this is being done not to take objects as war booty or as plunder, obviously, but a destruction to carry out a political and national heritage purpose to show that one group is the victor over some other group. Mm. Of course, this is something very much condemned by the world community, and there are possibilities now of war crimes being brought against people who perpetuate this kind of thing since World War II, because, of course, in World War II, we saw this on a massive scale. And since World War II, both at the Nuremberg trials and in the 1954 Hague Convention, that intentional destruction of cultural property during wartime is now considered an international crime against humanity.
Yeah. Since you touch on it, and I'm not sure how much more there is to say about the Afghan case, people are very concerned about the stated intention of the Taliban in Afghanistan to destroy, and at least the thing I've heard about recently is Buddhist statuary. And they are Muslim, and they believe that these are idols of a false god and that they shouldn't even exist. And the people around the world are very concerned about it. There have been offers to go and to remove the material so that it can be preserved. Some people might just like to stash that in their museum, or they might genuinely say, someday this will go back. And I think so far that the Taliban in Afghanistan have not seen particularly interested in that, and it's not an easy place to find out what to get into and find out what's going on. Anyway, it seems that it's a situation that there is no good answer for. Is there, in fact, anything that outside interests might do?
Well, I think you've mentioned what people are trying to do. I know that UNESCO has been trying to get into Afghanistan in order to find out what the situation is. My understanding is that so far there are no firsthand accounts of what is actually happening in Afghanistan, so we don't know the extent of the destruction. Much of what's been in the news has focused on the Buddhists because of the two monumental sculptures that are carved into the cliffside at Bamiyan, which happen to be Buddhist, the largest, in fact, Buddhist sculptures that are known. But I believe that there are certainly sculptures in other museums, smaller statuary in other museums in Afghanistan, not just in Kabul, but in other places that are not only remnants of Buddhist culture, but also earlier Greek-influenced cultures such as the Gandharan civilization. So I think there is more at risk here even than just the Buddhist, as significant as that is. Some museums, such as the Metropolitan Museum and I believe perhaps the Field Museum in Chicago, have offered to go in and remove sculpture. I don't think that the Taliban have displayed any interest yet in those offers, perhaps on the theory that just their mere existence of these sculptures anywhere in the world is an affront. On the other hand, Islamic scholars that I've talked to, and I'm not an Islamic scholar myself by any means, have said that, in fact, the presence of these sculptures is not an affront to Islam. So I think there's a lot of question and uncertainty as just what exactly is going on here.
And I think we should also for anyone listening, I wouldn't want to make it sound like I or you or anyone was making some sort of blanket indictment of Islam, based on the attitudes, beliefs, intentions of one particular group of Muslims. But
no, in fact, Islam, I believe, advocates tolerance of other religious views. And so I think that the Taliban is considered to be an aberration.
Well, I guess this does touch on the issue of national sovereignty. And if a particular country takes a particular attitude to what they have, I would expect that it would be difficult for outside powers to make some argument that they should be doing something different. At least that country could say, look, this is our country. These are our artifacts. We can do whatever we want with them. And so don't tell us what we should be doing. You can make the argument that there is something like a cultural heritage that belongs to all of humankind. But you still have the problem, I'm sure, with government saying, well, that's all well and good, but it's our country.
Certainly there is nothing that can be done within a particular country from a legal point of view. There is no international tribunal before which you can bring a particular country, although individuals, as I said before, could be brought for war crimes afterwards. However, I think that in some situations, at least, there is indirect pressure that can be brought. There's certainly what we call the court of world opinion, and that can be persuasive in some situations. I also think that when we talk about destruction caused by development, which it's very difficult to say to a country, don't engage in economic development, don't build a dam, don't engage in hydroelectric power projects. But I do think that world funding agencies or governments, for instance, of the United States, that may be involved in helping to fund different kinds of development projects could condition the funding on actions being taken to preserve the cultural heritage. And years ago, we saw a very good example of this with the Aswan Dam in Egypt, mm-hmm. That when the lake level was raised as part of a development project, museums and international organizations contributed funds, and ancient temples and sculptures that were located in the valley that would have been destroyed were raised. And in fact, some Egyptian antiquities were then given in gratitude to institutions outside of Egypt. And that was a perfect example of a cooperative effort that benefited everyone. And we need to come back to that. We don't have enough of that going on today, so that in cases like the Three Gorges Dam project in China and some other development projects, things are being lost. But if funding agencies on the international and national level were made more aware of these issues, I think we could make some progress where we'd be in a win-win situation.
We're about our midpoint here. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest. We're talking with Patty Gerstenblith. She's professor of law at DePaul University, and her area of interest is law and the arts, law and cultural heritage. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It's sort of my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in law, that the principle is if I buy something that's stolen, even if I don't know that it's stolen, if it can be established that it is, I'm out that object. If the owner can come along and establish the fact that it was stolen from them, it has to go back. And if I paid somebody money for it, that's I'm out that money. Have I got it right? That's basically what the law says.
Yes, you have it right, at least as far as the United States is concerned, mm-hmm. and some other countries that follow the British property law system. So that a thief can never convey good title, can never transfer good title. So you're right. If you buy something, whether you buy it arguably in good faith or not, or knowing about the uncertain background, the buyer will have to give it back. The exceptions to that are that we have something called statutes of limitation, which say that any kind of a lawsuit, this applies in personal injury and other kinds of actions as well, that there's a time limit within which a suit must be brought to recover the stolen property. So that, in theory, some of these claims could be barred by the passage of time. And this time period is relatively short in much of the United States, the maximum time being about 6 years. But it's interesting that most of the courts that have confronted this issue have found ways of essentially delaying that time period and saying that that 6 year, or in some cases it's 4 years or 3 years, time period will not start until the original owner has an opportunity to find out where, in fact, the stolen artwork is. After all, it's not fair. If you don't know where it is and you don't know whom to sue, And 6 years goes by, you lose your rights in the object. And a lot of courts are very sympathetic to that problem because it's easy to hide artworks. They're small and you can stick them away someplace and just let a couple years go by and suddenly you'd have effectively good title. So courts have found ways of delaying that time period. And in almost every case brought in the United States, the original owner of stolen artworks has been able to recover them.
Mm-hmm. And if, say, you have a situation where an individual steals a work of art and they sell it to somebody else and they sell it to somebody else and they sell it to somebody else and then that person sells it to me, the original owner comes along to me and says, this belongs to me, does the accountability eventually still come down with me because I've got it? Or can I say, well, look, it's not my problem. Go back a couple of people here. Go back to the person that sold it to the person that I bought it from.
Well, you're going to be out the object. You're going to have to give the work back. However, depending on how smart you were in the first place, you might have gotten some kind of warranty or contractual agreement with your seller that said that if you have to give it back, if the seller did not give you good title, then, in fact, you can go back and get your money back from your seller. And in theory, that could work its way back up the line. So you might well be able to get your money back, but you would probably have to give up the object. And in most cases, these objects are unique, and you'd probably rather have the object or the painting than your money back. But that's your problem because you chose to buy something without being absolutely certain that you were getting good title to it. Mm-hmm.
And is it always clear that something has been stolen, or is that sometimes for people who would make the argument that indeed something was stolen and should be returned to original owner or family of original owner or somebody who has a claim, is it sometimes difficult actually to establish what really did happen and how it got from point A to point B?
As a matter of fact, yes, because a lot of these go back to transactions that may have happened many, many years ago. Mm. The documentation may not be available. And, of course, we have the example of all the artworks that were looted during the Holocaust. It is now very difficult in some circumstances to determine just what happened. Was a painting sold or was it stolen? And when it was it sold as a forced sale? I mean, if somebody told, you can get out of Germany if you will sell us your paintings at a tenth of the price of what they were actually worth. Is that the kind of sale that today we want to say was a legitimate sale or not? So with artworks, these transfers and thefts take place over a very long period of time. 50 years is not that unusual. So it may be difficult to reconstruct what happened all those many years ago. But still, the courts try to do that. That's their job.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about art and about the looting of art. Seems as though if we look at Britain looted enormous amounts of artwork from India and Greece and Egypt at different times when they controlled these areas. Now, crown jewels, as a matter of fact, are some stolen items. Get right down to it. The Star of India being one. How does that go along with this? Everybody knows that these people hauled it out of this country and took it back to India or to the British Museum and had these frescoes on shown off from Greece and the Acropolis and stuff. How does that work into it?
We did actually an earlier caller raised the same question, but no, that's okay. I mean, there might have been some other people who didn't hear that. And I think it's certainly an interesting issue that that museums all over the world, certainly in the West, in this country and in Europe, have objects that were taken from, as the caller says, were taken from the Middle East, were taken from Africa, from East Asia, from all over the place. And I'm sure for them it's very complicated because if they actually had to give them back to the countries that they came from, their museums might be pretty empty.
Definitely.
But in this particular – well, we talked a little bit about the Elgin marbles in the British Museum and the fact that the people in Britain, if you go out and you ask them, they'd say, well, yeah, I think we should give these back. The museum so far doesn't seem to be real interested in giving them back. Is that a big issue at not only that museum, but museums around the world?
It certainly is a fear. Museums are always saying that they are afraid that their galleries will be emptied by all of these claims being brought. The truth is, though, that countries don't necessarily want everything back. In some cases, they want the highly unique objects that are emblematic of their culture and civilization. And certainly Greece does want to get the Parthenon sculptures back because I think that they are emblematic of Greek civilization, and their placement on the Parthenon in the center of Athens was certainly symbolic to them. But I guess I would also like to focus attention on the fact that rather than trying to go back two or three centuries and undo everything and right all of the wrongs, and I do have certainly a lot of sympathy for the countries whose heritage was removed through colonial imperialistic activities, but I think we should also focus attention on what's going on today. The sites that are being looted today, museums that are being, things are being pillaged out of museums. And I think that what we should really focus on is prospectively. What can we do to stop these activities that are happening today or they're likely to be happening over the next several years? And so just talking about things that are currently in museums and whether they should go back is a bit of a diversion to some extent, in my view, from the real issues, which is how do we stop what's going on today? So we should be talking about both educational efforts, legal efforts, public opinion efforts to change the way our museums operate and our private collectors operate to reduce the effect of the market on the looting and theft which is going on at this time.
Could I ask you one other question?
Sure.
And it deals with art, but not exactly art theft. What's going on with the Taliban or in Afghanistan now and their destruction of these enormous Buddhas that were carved centuries ago?
Oh, we talked about that, too.
Oh.
You should have tuned in for the first half. And there, unfortunately, I think the answer is that while there is a lot of concern around the world, there doesn't really seem to be very much that that outsiders can do.
Truly a shame in it, because there's many areas that are being looted just like that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Other questions, certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Patty Gerstenblith from DePaul University, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second, staying with this issue of, for example, the material that was taken from Greece and is now in Britain. Is there some precedent? Have there in recent years been any sort of deals worked out government to government, say, a government of one country to government of other, if there's something that a government regards as part of this country's important cultural heritage that previous, no matter when it was removed, and government A is really arguing that it should be returned and that they managed to work something out?
There have been some examples. There was a sculpture called the Afo Akom that was returned to Africa from the United States several years ago because of its religious and cultural significance. There have been things certainly returned within Europe. Crown of St. Stephen, I think is the name of it, was returned. I believe it was to Hungary a couple of years ago. Some things have been returned within, for instance, England, giving back things to Scotland as part of the devolution of government within the United Kingdom. So there have been some examples of that. And we also have had some examples of museums returning things as part of settlement of lawsuits or under legal pressure, in some cases even complete trials and legal suits to governments abroad as well. And we have some cases where the United States government has assisted other countries to obtain return of objects as well.
We have others here now. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I would think that England could make copies of the Elgin marbles and send the originals back. But I also have read that the fact that they were removed from England is part of what saved them from destruction.
Or from Greece.
Or from Greece, yeah, sorry. I meant from Greece to England. So it's sort of a double bind there. You never know when removal is going to save something. But I think it really is truly a shame when things get stolen from a particular country. We lived in Nepal for a while, and you could see places where things were just missing. Just a lot of the religious art is in very public places, and or at least out in the open, and things were just sometimes gone, and it's truly a shame.
Yeah. Well, that is in one of the arguments that that is sometimes made for the removal of this material from its place of origin. Some people would argue, well, taking it from there and putting it in a museum somewhere means that it will be preserved, and that there's something I suppose trying to put a positive spin on looting, but people have made that argument.
Well, certainly, and in some cases, I guess the individual object may be preserved. As far as the Parthenon sculptures are concerned, there was also a lot of destruction done in the process of removing them to both the building and the sculptures themselves. So which way they would have done better or worse is, of course, very difficult for us to judge today in hindsight and second-guessing what was going on. But I think that the issue that we should focus on is that in the removal of objects today, whether from architecture, monumental sculptures, or things being looted out of the ground, there is a lot of other information that's being lost. And this is the crux of the issue, I think. It's not just a question of whether an individual object is preserved in sort of pristine condition in a museum, but all of the context of information that can be gathered through the archaeological and scientific excavation of a site. That is what is being lost, is this information that tells us about the object. An object by itself does not give us full information. And a lot of times we don't know what the object was used for. We don't know what it was found with. We don't know, for instance, if it comes out of a tomb, we can study the relationship of the objects, how they were placed to each other, what else was in the tomb. We can study the skeleton and how the skeleton was located, and a lot can be learned from study of the bones themselves. And all that is lost if, let's say, the tomb group has been looted. Mm-hmm. The smaller objects may be destroyed. The skeletal remains may be destroyed. Certainly the soil that could be analyzed to tell us about diet and other kinds of agricultural information that comes, or particularly out of a habitation site. So a lot more is lost. So the question becomes, is preservation, the physical preservation of the single object, worth the destruction of the rest of the information and other objects that would come with it, objects that may not be as attractive to be sold on the market. Leaving objects buried in the ground does not generally destroy them. They've been there for hundreds or thousands of years, and they will in most cases, unless there's a major earthquake or some other calamity that we can't help, leaving them in the ground does not hurt them. And at some point, presumably, they will be excavated. Sometimes they are found, of course, through development projects, as we talked about earlier in the show. But eventually, they can be excavated scientifically. So this is the real question. Individual isolated objects versus the whole context of information that we can gain.
We have about 10 minutes left, and one more call, and we'll get right to, and others certainly are welcome. We're talking in this part of Focus 580 with Patty Gerstenblith. She's professor of law at DePaul University, and this is her area of specialty, law and the arts. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Next caller is in Rantoul, line 3. Hello.
Hi. My interest is not necessarily on the looting of nations, but just recovery of, like, just stolen art in general. Is there a clearinghouse that shares information? I had read something in Smithsonian about an agency that worked on collating information for stolen art. Is there something like that, or...
There are now several computerized databases. Perhaps the best known, and the one you may be referring to, is run by the International Foundation for Art Research. And they do compile lists of artworks that have been stolen. So, for instance, if you own a painting and it's stolen, you can give the information and register it with IFAR. And if you're thinking of buying something, many dealers and certainly the auction houses will routinely run objects through the IFAR computerized database to find out if there has been a claim listing these as stolen. And there are several other computerized databases as well that are not necessarily as well known. Also, today, several museums are conducting research into objects that have a gap in their history during the period of World War II, and they are starting to place the objects with those gaps on their own websites so that people can search to see if something from their family may show up in one of these museum collections. But none of these databases are complete.
Yeah.
And so it's still somewhat of a haphazard process. Also, they do not work for things looted from the ground. They only work for things taken from private and public collections.
That's what I was thinking, whatever. Everything up, the conversation today had dealt primarily with like looting of a nation on a wide scale, and I was thinking of just like the family jewels, whatever. So I didn't know whatever you'd, if you'd have the you know have any knowledge of that or not. So thank you.
All okay. right, and thank you. And we'll go again to another caller here, Champaign County, line 4.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Since you brought up this idea of sort of damage in the process of taking other things out, I think that I recall that some major archaeological associations have sort of condemned some practice. I don't know how widespread it is, and that's what I'm asking about in Israel, where earlier, more recent, well, anyway, the way it's excavated is that, you know, basically the Palestinian, Philistine, whatever, artifacts are not regarded as that valuable or important. And in other words, they'll dig down and go to a deeper level to look for signs of Chaldean, I don't know, earlier stuff. Do you know anything about the specifics of that? I'll listen off the air. But I also wanted to comment at the top of the show, David, you said that illicit trade was arms, drugs, and artwork, but actually just recently, and I guess on International Women's Day, it's good to point it out that illicit trade in women has actually surpassed the dollar amount of illicit trade in drugs.
Hmm.
So I think maybe art might be down there at 4. Not that that, you know, takes away from the seriousness of it.
I was not aware of that.
Maybe ask your next guest. Anyway,
indeed so. Well, thanks for the call. And you want to comment on any of that?
Well, on the first point, some archaeologists, particularly what I would call older-style archaeologists, would go into the field primarily interested in a certain time period. And if there were more recent layers representing more recent civilizations above those, there might be cases where material was lost and not as carefully excavated or in some cases even bulldozed. I think that most archaeologists, or at least those who are trained in scientific field technique, no longer follow those practices today. But I can't deny that it goes on in various parts of the world. There have certainly been allegations that it goes on in Israel. There have been allegations that it goes on in the Arab countries as well. I don't myself know specifically whether these have been documented, but in any kind of destruction, whether it's caused by archaeologists or by looters, I would certainly condemn that, and I think the major archaeological organizations would do that as well. I have not seen the statistics about the trade in women or children, although there certainly is an international slave trade in those, and it would be nice if we could, in fact, get the statistics out of organizations such as Interpol so mm-hmm. that we could have a better idea of what we're talking about.
Well, certainly we know that the trade in smuggled art is big business. Right. There's a lot of money here. And one of the things you talked about in your talk was some of the things that might be done. And you talked about perhaps one of the things that should be done is to make sure that we really put the burden of proof, so to speak, really on the buyer, that before people buy something, they should be the ones to make sure that the seller has clear title and this has not been obtained illegally. Although based on what we talked about earlier, I would think that buyers would already be doing that because if it was established that it was stolen, not only would they lose the object, they'd lose what they paid for it. So if it was me, I would want to do everything that I could to make sure that the person who sold it to me had got this thing legally.
So one would think. but we find that there are private collectors and even museums in the United States that ignore this. The truth is that it takes a lot of money to get an object back. Legal representation is expensive. Litigation is expensive. And very often museums and the private collectors have greater financial resources available to them to defend themselves in such lawsuits. And it seems that a lot of them are willing to take that chance. Hmm. I think particularly where museums are concerned, where whether they are publicly or privately funded, but even if privately funded, they're getting indirect public benefits, museums should have a responsibility to conserve their resources, and they should not be taking these risks. Museums should be working out acquisitions policies to try to ensure that they are not buying anything illegal, both because of their public educational role, but also because they have a responsibility to be financially sound. And a lot of these decisions do put them at risk for losing a great deal of money. But not all museums in the United States have taken that position as yet.
Yeah. The other thing that you that's really connected with that that you'd suggest is there really ought to be a clear stigma attached to knowingly buying something that's stolen or maybe buying something and just not caring. And again, that and maybe we've touched on already, but that's sort of a little bit disappointing to hear that there seem to be apparently people who just they really don't care. They want something. They want it bad enough. They got the money. They don't care where it came from.
Right. And it is surprising because, as I've mentioned, over 90% of the American public that was polled about a year ago on their attitudes towards archaeology, over 90% said that museums and people in the United States should not be buying things that are illegally obtained. Yet we do find at least some of our leading museums in this country, as well as private collectors whose actions are more difficult to control, really engage in what at best is willful ignorance, closing their eyes to what most people really do know is going on. And it will require a lot of public pressure, I think, and education, boards of trustees, as well as the professional and curatorial staffs of museums needs to be brought to understand, as I said, both the educational loss and scientific loss, as well as the legal risks that they are running.
Yeah. And that, I guess, also gets at the question about whether or not governments, particularly our government, thinks that this is a problem or not.
Oh, I do think our government does think so. Certainly some parts of the government, our State Department is working with other nations to try to help with that. I think the other problem becomes that there is a lot of lobbying and political influence by some museums and, again, and private collectors who have the money to not only engage well-heeled lobbyists and lawyers, but who have close ties with some of our legislators. So I think this is part of a bigger problem, but we see it even in this part of the world that issues like campaign finance reform and control of lobbying are things that would help us on this issue as well.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop. I want to say thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here. Very interesting to talk with you. Our guest, Patty Gerstenblith, she's professor of law at DePaul University.